I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox, a file sharing and personal data storage company that allows users to access their content from any of their devices. Drew co-founded Dropbox with his MIT classmate, Arash Ferdowsi, in 2007. Prior to starting Dropbox, Drew ran another startup, an online SAT prep company called Accolade. He incidentally scored 1600 on his SAT. Drew is from Acton, Massachusetts. Welcome.
Thank you.
There has been a great evolution in storage, from storing files of paper on a shelf to burning CDs to using memory sticks to now storing things in the cloud. How does Dropbox fit into all this?
Yeah, we think about the things you put in Dropbox are the things that kind of were things you would store in your house, right? So you'd open your front door, you put your mail down on the table, photos on the coffee table in the living room, work documents in your briefcase, a filing cabinet somewhere with your financial and health information. All that stuff lives on servers. All that stuff now lives on services like Dropbox. And so we all need our kind of digital home in the cloud. And we think of what we're building as kind of this magical home for all your most important information.
From the photos on your coffee table to, you know, your photos in the cloud, there's been a lot in between.
Right. Yeah, it's just a mess. Mm-hmm. When anytime some new technology comes along, the old stuff doesn't go away. You're taking all these pictures on your phone, but all your old computers, there's still photos stuck in all those places, and you still have the shoebox under your bed and the, you know, the photos on your fridge. And it's kind of up to you to kind of duct tape all this stuff together.
We talk about storage in the cloud, but there are servers that are actually helping to maintain this. Where do your servers live?
So there's a lot of them. They live on both the West and East Coast. You know, in case anything happens in any place, your stuff will always be safe. Since the beginning, we manage and buy and operate a bunch of our own servers, and then we've also used the public cloud, which refers to places like Amazon. They have Amazon Web Services, and they buy a bunch of servers and manage them and rent them out to companies like ours. And that made it really easy for us to get started because, you know, back then we couldn't afford to spend tens of millions of dollars on equipment, and we could just get started with a credit card.
When did you first think of the idea for Dropbox?
Well, it was out of personal frustration, and one day I forgot my thumb drive. I was taking a trip from Boston to New York. I justified this in my head because I was going to spend the weekend there by thinking of, oh, if I take the bus, I can have, you know, 4.5 hours in each direction, and so 9 hours to get all these things done. And so rush to the bus, get on there, have a seat, open up my laptop, and I paused and had that feeling in the pit of my stomach. I just knew that I had left my little thumb drive with all my company stuff on it back at home. And these were the days before the iPhone and kind of thing where if you didn't have anything to do, you really didn't have anything to do. So I had 4.5 hours to think about how disorganized I am, and I'm like, I never want to have this problem again.
Now, there's a lot of like myth-founding stories. Is that actually what happened, or had you been kind of marinating on versions of this even before that momentous epiphany?
Well, I had, at the time, there were all kinds of other services that claimed to do this on paper. At MIT, I had hacked together a bunch of little tools to try to help me manage this, but it was really that bus ride where the first lines of code, I started typing in the first lines of code.
Now, you applied to Y Combinator, which is a seed accelerator or an incubator that in exchange for equity, they give you now roughly, I think, $120,000 to help you get your business started.
They were a little leaner than me.
They were. It was more like
$15,000. Like
$15,000,
yeah.
Right. Paul Graham said to you, well, you need to find a co-founder if we're going to accept you.
Right.
Now, you had a co-founder prior. He was a Stanford grad, but he couldn't join you because he had a friend who was starting like a competing technology. So you went to Arash, who had gone to MIT, but you didn't know him at MIT. How did that happen?
It's kind of a long story. A little bit of co-founder musical chairs. So it turned out, as you said, I had a bunch of people who would have been great, but just timing wasn't right. And I was just complaining to anyone who would listen that I'd need a co-founder. And what happened was a friend of mine who I'd also met at MIT named Kyle he knew Arash, and he's like, you guys should really talk. And so we got together in the student center. I think there was a coffee house on the second floor. And now in retrospect, it's kind of crazy because we spent maybe a total of a couple hours together before completely jumping in.
And he dropped out of MIT.
Yeah, it was wild.
So you and Arash completed Y Combinator, and that led you accidentally to another person named Pejman Nozad.
Yeah, Pejman Nozad.
And he was talking Farsi to Arash, because they both happened to be Iranian, and he was taken with your technology. And he was kind of a pivotal person for you very early on, because he introduced you to Sequoia, to your first venture capital.
Yeah, it was wild. Pejman came running up to Arash after our demo at Y Combinator, but we hadn't really heard of him, but he was very persistent and convinced us to come down, and we'd type in the address, and we'd go down to Palo Alto on University Ave, and we get out of the car, and we're like, oh man, we're already running late. This is the wrong place. This is some like rug gallery. But we go inside, and we're like, hey, we probably have the wrong place, but it's Pejman here. The receptionist's like, oh sure, come back here, and you know, you look around, it's just rugs. But we go through this like secret back doorway into this boardroom, and we sit down. They serve us Persian tea. We walk mm-hmm. him through a demo, and next thing we know, he's introducing us to Sequoia. He came with us to the first pitch.
It was his family's rug company that he was operating from, and he actually said to Sequoia, "Oh yes, you know they're talking to other venture capitalists who want to invest to just
move things along."
And Michael Moritz from Sequoia shows up at your apartment one Saturday morning to say, "Here is your $1.2 million." is that accurate?
More or less, yeah. We go to Sequoia on a Friday, and I get a phone call that night saying, "Hey, you know, we really like you guys. Next step is usually to have a partners meeting on Monday, but Mike isn't going to be there. Can he come visit on Saturday morning?" And I'm thinking, Mike. And I was mm-hmm. like, oh, God, yeah, Mike Moritz, mm-hmm. who's like the godfather of Sequoia. And yeah, next thing you know, he's in our living room. Mm-hmm. Our boxes literally aren't even unpacked. Mm-hmm. And we're walking him through a tour of Dropbox.
I want to go back to your Y Combinator application for a moment, because we're talking about raising capital, and they ask you about that on the application. You know, if somebody's interested in buying your company, you know, what would you do? And you'd said, I'd rather see the idea through, but I'd probably have a hard time turning down $1 million after taxes for 6 months of work.
Right.
But then Steve Jobs offers you 9 digits in 2009. How did you come into contact with Steve originally?
Dropbox was kind of on their radar.
Because you had hacked their system.
The team at Apple had gotten in touch because we did some kind of crazy technical acrobatics with the operating system. And so we did this kind of open heart surgery on this thing called the Finder, which is what shows you your files, which is a technically very difficult thing to do. And so they were confused. They're like, how did you guys do that? And we were thinking, why are you asking us? Like, you guys aren't the people who do that like 100 feet away from you? Mm-hmm. That was what started things. And then they wanted to have conversations about maybe buying the company and eventually kind of move up the food chain to Steve.
What surprised you about the encounter?
Our meeting with Steve was really cordial. And the encounters usually fell into two buckets. You either got chill Steve or very angry Steve. Fortunately, it was the former. He's just like, look, you should join us. And we said, look, we're huge admirers of everything you've done, but we're really having a great time building this company. I'm sure you understand. And that's when I thought he'd get upset. But he started taunting us a little bit and saying all these reasons why it wouldn't work, or, you know, it was unlikely to work, and how they were going to have to compete with us and kill us and these kinds of things. But what was fun about it was that it was all kind of done in 15 minutes, and he spent the next 45 minutes just talking to us about entrepreneurship and his path. And you know, I was asking him all these questions about why'd he come back to Apple, and he didn't have to do that.
And P.S., he comes out with iCloud, which is a competitor to Dropbox, but you knew it was coming because he told you he was coming out with a cloud-based solution similar to yours. And even at the time, you know, your customer base wasn't obviously what it is today. You have over 300 million users.
Right.
But at the time, it was more like 2 million?
It's probably about 2 million.
And you acquired those customers in kind of quirky ways. One was with referrals, that if a user referred a friend, that they got more storage for free.
Yeah.
And that was kind of taking a page out of PayPal's playbook, right?
Right. If I tell you about Dropbox, you get some free space, I get some free space. We found that of all the things we tried, that was really effective. And people try to collect space, kind of like points, even if they didn't use it. That quickly became the primary way that people found out about Dropbox.
You also made a video in the middle of the night demonstrating the service. Very simple. That really resonated mostly with the tech community.
Right. So it was this quick video just narrating the experience of Dropbox. But what we did was we put all these little Easter eggs in the video that people who frequently went to sites like Reddit or Dig, things that that community would understand. And so I learned that from a book called Guerrilla Marketing, which is how do you reach people when you have no money? And it just took off. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people visited in the first day. 75,000 people signed up to try Dropbox. It was literally overnight that we built our critical mass.
By the way, you said you read it in a book called Guerrilla Marketing, which I'm guessing you read on the roof of your fraternity at MIT, where you got your default MBA.
Yes.
And which I'll get to later. But I want to talk about that video, because as I was watching the video, I saw some like very funny names for files laying around. Like you had one file called People Have No Idea Why They're Doing What They're Doing. Did you make up these file names?
Yeah. Even if you weren't interested in Dropbox, something in there might catch your attention. So there are always funny file names. There's XKCD comics. There's a picture of Tom Cruise jumping on a couch. There's references to Obama. He was campaigning back then. We found that it worked.
So where do you get your sense of humor from?
I guess that's a good question. I think, you know, my mom has a great sense of humor. Both of my parents are pretty lighthearted and funny.
I have to admit, I kind of fell into using your service because when I was downloading photos from my iPhone one day, Dropbox kind of appeared and I almost had to use it. Now I'm locked into you forever because even though I had your service for free initially, I now have to pay you monthly?
Mm-hmm. Monthly, yearly.
So you are a Trojan horse in a way. You know, on the one hand, I'm grateful because I know, okay, my photos are safe in addition to the other places I store it. But on the other hand, I'm like, I'm going to have to pay this service ongoing. And that's obviously your hope.
Right.
How do you navigate that? What percent of the people who use Dropbox pay for the service?
Most of the users are free users. But obviously that's how we make the model work is that if you need more space, you can subscribe. But we have to earn that. And so we're always doing more to make the experience better. And hopefully when you look at your credit card statement, it's one of the things that makes you happy and not sad.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox. We'll hear more from Drew coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox, a file hosting service that allows you to store, share, and access your personal data among any of your devices. Drew graduated from MIT in 2006, and before starting Dropbox, he founded an online SAT prep company called Accolade and created a poker bot, which helps you win at online poker. Who knew?
That's right.
Are you a poker player?
I am. Not a great poker player.
Was this like a for-profit endeavor or just something that you were kind of having fun reverse engineering software on a computer one day?
It was a little of both. So I love poker, but what was appealing is since I was little, I've always loved taking things apart. You know, whether it's online poker or all kinds of things, I was able to figure out sort of the inner workings of how the poker app worked, and I was able to create something where the mouse would move itself and click and figure out what's going on with the game and the artificial intelligence to play. But then, unfortunately, in 2006, poker became illegal or more illegal. And so, you know, I thought to really scale this out would be a lot of different felonies you'd have to commit. Mm-hmm. So I decided to put my attention elsewhere.
There's an image or a story I've heard about you going up to New Hampshire to visit your family in their cottage. You have a car full of your computers and wires to work on this poker bot. Can you tell me about just what that looked like?
Yeah, so we have a little place in New Hampshire on a lake, and you know, most normal people like go swimming and canoeing around and things like that. And you know, I drive by and you know, my mom's like saying, like says hello, and I'm dragging three monitors out of my trunk and setting them up on, it's like I put them on the stove. And I was hooking everything up, and my mom was like, what are you doing? But she knew, this is one of many kind of schemes and projects I've had.
What was your mother's view of that sort of ingenuity?
She's always found it just funny and, you know, just entertaining to watch me and my siblings. My parents, I'm really lucky, and they've always been supportive of everything I've done. They find all of this just pretty funny.
What do your parents do?
So my mom, she just retired. She was a high school librarian at my high school. And my dad is a staff engineer at Draper Lab in Cambridge.
I heard that you've been coding since you were 5 years old.
That's right.
What does that mean? How does a five-year-old code?
So I was lucky. And when I was in diapers and sort of running into the living room, my dad had bought a PC Junior. And so I would, even before I could really read or do anything, I was kind of mashing the keys, and eventually got to the point where my dad was able to show me how to play games and write my first lines of code.
Did you get outdoors a lot, though, as well?
Yes. My siblings and I were limited in our computer time, so we'd have to take turns and be normal for the rest of the time.
We alluded to this at the beginning, but your mom was a librarian, and did it kind of resonate with you that what you're doing is kind of a later form of library work?
We think about that a lot. We store a ton of information in Dropbox, as you can imagine, with hundreds of millions of people using the service, and every day people store probably dozens of libraries of Congress. Mm-hmm. This is every day.
I want to talk about a speech that you gave at MIT. You talk about the circle of five, which basically is the five people in your life you spent most time with. Can you describe that briefly?
So I think there was a quote I read somewhere that you're the average of the five people you spend time with the most. It's an interesting observation for me because it prompted me to do a lot of different things. It prompted me to move out to San Francisco because that's kind of what Hollywood is to the entertainment industry, Silicon Valley and San Francisco are to internet companies. And when I think of what some of the most important, sort of in retrospect, what some of the most important things I've done, it's really been going to places like MIT, surrounding myself with people that push me in sort of friendly competition.
And one of those people for you was Adam Smith, who was a classmate of yours from MIT. And you say that you would code in your boxers at your fraternity because the air conditioning didn't work. And all of a sudden, you know, he's getting serious and he's getting venture capital and he's getting flown around in helicopters. And that was just the kick in the butt that you needed. Can you describe that?
Yeah. So Adam started a company about almost exactly a year before me. And we would spend the summer coding together, and he was working on his company, and I was working on my first company. But very quickly, after that summer, he moved out to California. And next thing I knew, I get this phone call from him saying, hey, this investor, Vinod Khosla, is going to give me $5 million.
And Vinod Khosla, for those who don't know,
is the founder, one of the co-founders of Sun Microsystems. He's this really legendary character in the Valley, and he has a big venture capital firm. And so I was just shocked. I mean, I was super happy for him, but at the same time, I'm like, oh my God, I'm not getting Publishers Clearing House size checks.
And this is the friendly competition you're talking about. In addition to talking about, you know, the circle of five, you talk about the tennis ball. What is that?
When I was working on my first company, after a while, I sort of lost steam. And I thought something's wrong with me, or like, why can't I work hard? But then actually the PokerBot was the project that reminded me that I was obsessed with that thing. And when I think of that kind of obsession, I thought of our dog growing up, Whimsy. When you would throw a tennis ball, she would just go bounding after it, like bashing through stuff, just kind of just tongue hanging out, just looking a little bit crazy. And when I think about people who have done really amazing things, it's really kind of that obsession. And that's what I recognized when I started working on Dropbox, is this is a problem I can be really excited about for a long time.
Even though you're young, you're also mindful of kind of your numbered days. And, you know, you read somewhere that you have basically 30,000 days to live.
I remember this one night right after moving to San Francisco, reading that, yeah, that you live for 30,000 days. And, you know, at first I'm like, okay, this is like a clinically obvious fact. But on a whim, I just opened up the calculator and I typed it in, and I'm like, oh my God, Like, I was 24 at the time or something, and I'm 9,000 days down, almost a third of the way through life. That was just kind of a shock to me that, you know, every day we kind of get a ticket until you don't. And so it really caused me to think about how do you make every day count?
So what's an example of how that influences what you're doing?
For a lot of life, you spend your time, like, checking boxes and, like, getting ready to do things. And when I look at a lot of my friends, a lot of them may have wanted to start a company at some point, but they kind of they basically spend all these years getting ready to start a company, and then before they know it, they've got kids and a mortgage, and they just don't have the flexibility they had. Instead of trying to get ready, I was just like, all right, I'm just going to do this.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox, a file hosting service that allows you to store, share, and access your personal data among any of your devices. You mentioned in your application to Y Combinator that you were in a crowded, hostile, competitive environment and that there were lots of companies trying to do what you were doing. And I actually appreciated your candor in the application. You know, you're saying, yeah, you know what? There's not a lot of barriers to entry, but what makes us different is that we're going to execute carefully. What made you think you could do it better or execute better than others? And why were you not daunted by going into such a crowded sector?
What we would say to investors is like, look, if any of these things worked, like I wouldn't be here. I'd just use that. Tom Cruise in Minority Report, do you really think he's going to be like carrying a thumb drive around, right? Or like logging into his Gmail to pick up the thing he had like emailed himself. Mm-hmm. Like obviously your stuff would just follow you around and mm-hmm. that's not our idea. That idea has been around since my parents were kids. But none of us had that. We had it sort of at school, but then you graduate and it's like back to the Stone Age and I'm my own IT guy. There are a lot of startup ideas that are kind of like that, where it's a terrible idea. Like mobile was like that for a long time. It's just this graveyard until one day, you know, the iPhone comes along and it just works. Or music startups, you know, just didn't work. Then you have Spotify and Pandora. And so I think if the problem is still unsolved, it doesn't really matter how many competitors there are.
Because, though, of the competitive space, the costs are so low, and you talk about file sharing just being chapter one of what you're doing.
Sure.
You're constantly having to innovate, where you're going beyond just being that file sharing service.
Well, our space is evolving, and it's like any other technology. So, I mean, think about your first cell phone. In the beginning, you're like, oh, my God, I can be in my car, and I can be talking. This is like magic. And you're like, okay, how many minutes do I have for my phone calls? Now cell phones do much more than just phone calls. Dropbox is kind of like that, where it's like, oh, I can have my stuff with me wherever I am. I can access it from anywhere. How much space do I have? Now everybody knows that storage is just an ingredient, and it's a means to an end. But what people are really doing is they want to have everything in one place. They want to share. They want to collaborate. They want to get work done. And so those are the real problems we're solving. And things like sync or storage, we don't even really use those words that much because what we're really trying to do is solve the underlying problems.
You originally did not have the URL Dropbox.com. It was getdropbox.com. And you even started with Evenflow as the name of the company. Can you tell me the story about how you acquired the domain name?
Getting the domain name was kind of a crazy...
Because somebody else owned it.
Yeah, so we didn't have Dropbox.com in the beginning. We had getdropbox.com, so kind of a budget domain name.
How much did you pay for Dropbox ultimately?
We have to keep that secret, unfortunately. But what happened was there's this guy who lived in Pleasanton, which is near San Francisco, and for literally years, for the first couple of years of starting the company, I would call him and be like, hey, you know, we have an idea for this thing that we want to build. We see that you have Dropbox.com. Can we work something out? And he would say no every time. He's like, and we're like, why? And he's like, oh, I have a project. And it was clear after call 3, 4, 5, 10 that there was no project. And eventually we got so frustrated that we go downstairs, go to the convenience store, like buy the most expensive bottle of $40 champagne we could find, and get in a zip car and drive to his house and ring the doorbell. And he's a little shocked, but the crazy thing, he was an entrepreneur too. And so he sat us down. We tell him a little bit more about what we're doing. And he's like, this is interesting. Let me think about it. And we're like, this is really exciting. Awesome. We'll give you stock. We got great investors, all these things. I'm trying to get him interested. And he's like, I'll talk to you in a couple of days. We're like, we'll be back on Monday. And so we come back. We're like, you know, what do you think? He's like, no, I'm just going to hang on to it. And I'm like, are you serious? Like, you know, like bequeath it to your children? Like, what is the end game here? And he was just totally unreasonable. And what happened was he ended up putting all these ads on it that would confuse our users. So we actually ended up sort of, you know, rattling our swords and filing a lawsuit for trademark infringement because it was actually causing confusion. Our users were going to clicking on these ads, and he was making all this money off of confusing people. And so you can't do that. So eventually we got back in touch with him. We're like, look, you know, and neither of us wants to be in sort of embroiled in something like this. And finally he was able to sell it to us. And he probably should have taken stock. He sold it for cash, probably worth $100 million. Mm-hmm. So just a lot. Right. Paid him a lot less.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox, a file hosting service that allows you to store, share, and access your personal data among any of your devices. In addition to like customer acquisition and getting venture capital, what was one or two key pivotal moments in the progression of Dropbox in the early days?
Really getting people to understand how to use the product. And what I mean by that is we could see in the numbers that a lot of people would sign up and not start using it, which is always puzzling. And literally in a given day, you would see a note from someone saying, hey, this is like a godsend. This is the simplest, best thing ever. And the next email would be like, what is wrong with you guys? You need MIT nerds. Like, you need a PhD to figure this thing out. It's totally impenetrable, and I hate it. And so what we did was we went on Craigslist and offered like $30 or something if you'd come in and try Dropbox, and we just put a camera in there. I had a bunch of music equipment, so we would record people just trying out the product, and we found all of these hidden things that were these stumbling blocks. And it was really simple. We're just like, hey, have a seat. Here's an invitation email to Dropbox. Go from here to sharing a file with this email address. 0 of 5 succeeded. Like, they all, like, failed with prejudice. Like, most of them didn't even figure out how to get the thing installed.
Is that because of a trouble in the coding? Bugs in the coding?
You know, it's just kind of unexpected stuff. You know, after you install Dropbox, really, in a sense, it just puts you into this empty folder. And the only interaction you can have with it is through this little icon in the corner of your screen. And so people didn't notice the icon. They didn't notice that we were putting the folder there. They were totally baffled as to what this thing was. And so after that, we made a list of like 80 things that were confusing that we didn't even realize until, you know, they're all obvious in retrospect, but mm-hmm. And then we just kind of grinding through them.
That really helped to enhance the ease of use.
Yeah, it was a pivotal moment for us because I think it's really hard to see through your customer's eyes,
right?
Especially if you know every facet of every line of code and know exactly how the thing works. Right. You know, you're almost like screaming through the screen, like, just click the icon right there. How can you not see it?
What are some examples of anecdotes of people actually having success with this service?
I think it's really amazing to me how much it sort of feels like Dropbox has become part of the fabric of how we do all kinds of things. And, you know, everything from, you know, SNL, you know, mm-hmm. watch the 40th anniversary SNL episode, that's produced in Dropbox. Mm-hmm. You know, you turn on music, and pretty much every musician I talk to uses Dropbox. Or National Geographic, like all the, you know, flipping through the beautiful photos they have, that's all in Dropbox.
Now, when you say they're using Dropbox, so they're working collaboratively with other people on the files, on the content.
Right. And so they're moving big files around, they're collaborating.
What are other examples?
Someone emailed in, they're like, hey, we use Dropbox at this hospital, and it got flooded, and all of our patients' records were destroyed. But we had a backup in Dropbox, so it literally like saved people's lives. Mm-hmm. To more mundane or just sort of off-the-wall stuff, to our first head of marketing was here in New York and visiting her hairdresser. And they're making small talk. She's like, oh, where do you work? And Julia was like, I'm at Dropbox. And the hairdresser like dropped her stuff, and she's like, I love Dropbox. It's completely changed my life. And Julie's like, what? You know, the hairdresser, you know, makeup artist, not really the first target market we'd think of. And Julie's like, what do you mean? And she's like, well, I do all this production work for this movie. We have to shoot all the scenes out of order. And I got to run around with a clipboard writing down, like, your hair is here and you're wearing this earring and your bracelet and, you know, your sleeves are up. And it's a huge pain because I can't get anything wrong. But now all I do, I have an iPad. All the pre-production footage is in Dropbox. I just see, and when I want to see what were you wearing in the scene before this, I just look at the scene before it, and it's completely saved, you know, hours and hours and hours of my life. Never would have occurred to us that we're like creating like hairdresser workflow software.
And where do you store your data?
Oh my God, it's all in Dropbox.
All?
Yeah, as much as I can.
No iCloud?
So for like Find My iPhone, I use iCloud. You know, really all of us are going to end up using all of these services, and that creates a new problem. Like I need like a cloud to connect my clouds.
You love music. How long have you been playing the guitar?
Since the senior year in high school.
Your band Angry Flannel performs from time to time.
Yes.
Why the name Angry Flannel?
We basically had all gotten together. We didn't know each other that well, and we were bickering over the name. And we had interviewed a lot of bad singers. And I think afterwards, and everybody was all emotional, and I'm like, what are we here, like Angry Flannel or something? And it stuck. I had a chance to track down Eddie Vedder, who was the lead singer of Pearl Jam. They're investors in Dropbox. So he liked the name. He approved.
And speaking of Pearl Jam, Dropbox was originally called Evenflow, which is a Pearl Jam song.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I've been a big Pearl Jam fan for a long time. And we were worried because Dropbox.com wasn't available. If I wasn't going to put Dropbox, I had to put something in. So I'm a huge Pearl Jam fan. And the first name of the company or incorporation certificate still says Evenflow Inc.
And in addition to Pearl Jam being an investor, you too is an investor.
Yes.
Do you secretly wish you were a rock star?
I think that would be a pretty good path. You know, if I could take a year and like tour or be part of something like that would be really fun.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox. Coming up, we'll meet Dwight Merriman, co-founder of MongoDB. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dwight Merriman, co-founder of MongoDB, an open-source database company that focuses on helping companies manage their data in a more flexible, scalable way. Customers of MongoDB include the insurance company MetLife, Goldman Sachs, Facebook, and eBay, among several others. Dwight is also the co-founder of DoubleClick, the ad-serving platform that was acquired by Google for $3.1 billion in 2005. He's also co-founded the fashion e-commerce company Gilt Group and the news web platform Business Insider. Dwight is originally from Ohio and now lives in New York City, where MongoDB is based. Welcome.
Thank you.
So how does MongoDB work?
So MongoDB is a database. It's an open source database. This is a tool that engineers, software engineers use to build systems, right, to store data in. The MetLife example is, you know, MetLife's a large company, right? So you have all these divisions, all these products, all these different types of insurance. And in that big a company, how do you get a single view of all that information? So they're pulling in data from over 60 data sources internally into a single data store that's in MongoDB, so that when you call in, the person you're talking to trying to help you can see everything. The thing about those 60 databases they're pulling things in from is those databases are constantly changing, right? Those teams are making upgrades to those apps, and when they do that, the data in the database, the shape of that data changes, and now how do I react to that? I've got 60 inbound data streams, but they're all fluid, if you will. And it turns out with MongoDB, that's one thing it's very good at.
Now, your experience at DoubleClick, which you co-founded in 1995, established the germ for MongoDB. Can you talk about some of the frustrations that you were experiencing at DoubleClick?
Yeah, so I was the tech guy. I was CTO there. So, you know, we're building this system. We're serving 20, 30 billion ads a day, like 500,000 ads a second, you know, so we have big scalability challenges to deal with. You know, one of the challenges was data. It's so much data that the traditional way to scale is what we call called vertically, which means just buy a bigger server, right? But there's a limit on how big you can go vertically is a problem. And the other problem is those big servers are very expensive. So what we really want to do is we want to do what people do today with cloud computing, which is to scale horizontally, which says, okay, I got a really big database. It won't fit on one server. Tie together 100 servers into one database system. So that was something we really wished we had back then. So there was all these sort of like homegrown solutions, but there wasn't really anything out there just for everyone to use. These are generally available products. At some point, myself and my co-founders at Mongo, Elliot and Kevin, there's got to be a better way to do this. There needs to be a general solution to this. So we just started building something from scratch, which turned into MongoDB.
Where does the name MongoDB come from?
The idea was that the word Mongo is in the middle of the word humongous. And one of the key benefits of the product is this ability to have big scale and do big data, right? It also helps you do rapid application development very elegantly. But that it comes from that humongous. It was sort of the pun there.
MongoDB is open source, so developers are welcome and invited to help shape the infrastructure of MongoDB. What is the catalyst for the open source movement more generally? I mean, I think of Wikipedia, for example, as being my first encounter with what open source means.
It's actually, I think, a few things. One is, I think, the Free Software Foundation was a big proponent of this concept of free software. Which, you know, at first when you never heard of it, it sounds a little silly. It's kind of like free cars or something, right? But it actually turns out it does work. And then the internet, I think, was a big catalyst because to do this sort of community collaboration, going back to the Wikipedia analogy, you need some way for all these people to talk to each other and they're not all in the same place. So the internet facilitated open source, I think. And then another thing that helped a lot is actually IBM. In the early days of Linux, IBM came out and said, you know, we're going to invest a lot in Linux. And that was a big strategic decision by them. And that was a real milestone in open source, I think.
I want to talk about funding for a moment. You know, you've raised several rounds of funding from venture capitalists like Sequoia and Union Square Ventures and NEA and Goldman and Salesforce. They're investors. And in a way, people might be eager to jump in because it's kind of like by the guy. You've been successful in other ventures. You've raised so many rounds of capital. Can you talk to me a little bit about just that experience this time around?
Yeah, and it's interesting because the VCs, they don't buy the guy. They generally look at three things: the product, the team, and the business plan. They are buying the guy in the sense that, is the team good, right? It's not like you can go in and say, okay, I'm doing something new. I'm not going to tell you what it is. Would you like to invest? It was interesting because there was a point in time early on with MongoDB where I'm saying, you know, well, we have this new database. You know, it's not a relational database. It doesn't use SQL, which is the standard query language of everything else. But it's going to be extremely successful. You know, we're over 10 million downloads now. But at the time, you know, you're saying this and it's brand new. There's no metrics or anything yet. And they're just scratching their heads and they just don't understand, right? And then so they don't invest, right? So what I found was because of having done something in the past that was successful is everyone would take my meeting. But then once they took the meeting, it didn't really affect the outcome. You know, they took the meeting, and then afterwards, you kind of realize there's very little chance they were going to do it. There's a little bit of an inefficiency there. Like, their interest level is low, not high, or their intrigue, let's say, yet they take the meeting anyway. You burn cycles on it. So that was amusing. And then, of course, then later, then it's different, right? Then it's a metrics-driven analysis, and then they're happy to invest.
I want to talk about your personal life for a moment to understand better how you became this serial entrepreneur, not just with MongoDB, but DoubleClick and Guild Group and Business Insider and Panther Express and, oh, what have I missed? But you grew up in Ohio. Where in Ohio did you?
In southwestern Ohio, rural.
What did your parents do?
My dad, he owned a commercial construction company. He did a lot of actually commercial farm construction, things like grain elevators and grain bins and things that are 300 feet tall and things like that. So That was what he did, and my mother was, she was at home.
Do you have brothers or sisters?
One of each.
And what was young Dwight Merriman like?
Pretty nerdy. Mm-hmm. I got my first computer when I was 14. Before that, I really didn't know what I wanted to do in life. But once I got a computer and used it for a day, it was pretty clear to me. I knew what I wanted to do. So what happened then is I ended up then just teaching myself the program and spending most of my free time fooling with the computer in, say, high school.
What else did you enjoy doing aside from being with your computer?
That was my main hobby, other than all the random things one does at that age, including, you know, video games, things like that.
You had your first job with a company called Intercomputer Communications in Cincinnati, Ohio. And the founder of the company is this guy, Kevin O'Connor. You followed Kevin to Atlanta, and you and he came up with this idea for DoubleClick. Can you talk about how you and he decided to start this company?
At that time, I was thinking, well, you know, I think I'd like to do a startup at some point, so maybe now is a good time. At this point, I was pretty young, so we started that summer of 1995. We met once a week and brainstormed just ideas in Atlanta. And by the end of the summer, we had a list or a spreadsheet with 100 ideas on it. Most of them were internet-related because to us, it was clear internet was a big trend at that point. And the one we picked was this concept of an internet advertising network. You know, here's this big trend, the internet. You know, you're going to have millions of sites, millions of advertisers. You know, how does that work? You know, there's too many parties on both sides for them to just talk to each other manually. We need some kind of system and technology to do this. You know, there's got to be an economic model for this internet thing. You know, how are these sites going to pay the bills? And at that point in time, it wasn't clear what that economic model was going to be. You know, would it be subscription, you know, or would it be something else, like maybe advertising? And that back then, actually, it looked more like subscription, you know, because you think about things like AOL was a subscription, and you got both access and content. So we ended up kind of going a different way and saying, well, actually, I think advertising would work. And the interesting thing is at the time is that Kevin O'Connor and myself, neither of us knew anything whatsoever about advertising. Actually, he went to the library and got basically a textbook on advertising and sat down and read it.
What were one or two things that really worked that you got right, would you say?
Yeah. So there were a couple key decisions that if we got them wrong, it would have not worked. One big decision was, I remember we went to meet with Dow Jones, Wall Street Journal, because they have a website, right? You know, so we go in and say, well, join the network. We'll sell your ads for you. And their response was, well, we want to sell ads on our website, so we do have a need, but we've been selling advertising for 100 years. Can we just buy the technology? So this created an interesting question then, is like, what is your answer to that question? This is the kind of secret sauce of the ad network, you know, because there was competitors out there at this point. If there's a differentiation, it's on the technology. So to then unbundle it and sell it to anyone, you're cannibalizing yourself, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. So we decided to do it. We took the underlying technology of it, Dart, and we sold it. We made it available for sale to anyone who wanted to sell ads themselves. And so that unbundling was a big decision. And it was sort of a key decision because in the end, the reason it was valuable was because it was an internet advertising technology product. There wasn't a lot of value in the ad network in the end.
Thank you, Dow Jones, Wall Street Journal, because had you not had that meeting, I mean, you might have come to that decision at some point.
Yeah.
But interesting that a customer asked you for it. And that was the inspiration for that pivot.
Yeah.
You are married to a woman, Jody Richard. At what point in all of this business creation did you meet her?
I met her at my first job, so before DoubleClick.
How did you meet?
At work.
Oh, she worked there.
She worked there, so we're in the same office, so it's very easy.
And she herself is an entrepreneur of sorts. She started with you a restaurant in New York called Aterra, which is a 18-seat, two Michelin star restaurant that serves, you know, an 18 to 20 course tasting menu. Was that her initiation, or are you both interested in food and wine and?
It was her doing. We're both interested in food and wine. It's a hobby for us. But it's 99% her and sort of like 1% me.
Kevin Ryan is somebody whom you met at DoubleClick, and he has been a partner through many of your startups since DoubleClick. Why do you think you and he work so well?
We work extremely well together and are extremely complementary, and it's just completely random. It seems like 98, 99% of the time we agree on things, which is rare. That's not essential with a business partner, but it creates huge efficiency. And then also, I think just we do get along great, and our skill sets are complementary because, you know, Kevin is a business guy by background, and I'm a tech guy by background. And over time, we're both learning a little bit about the other sides.
He's typically on the front end of the company, if you will, and you're, you know, behind the scenes kind of making it work.
Yeah, that's especially true at DoubleClick, where I was CTO. You know, at MongoDB, for the first 5 years or so, I was CEO. So that is more outward facing, but fundamentally, I'm an introvert, so I just like to build things.
So here's this boy from Ohio whose father works in construction, in rural construction, and here you are in 2005, 10 years after you start DoubleClick, you know, experiencing a sale to Google. What went on personally through that?
This actually played out over quite a bit of time,
yes.
Right? So from Ohio till the company was sold was kind of 15-ish years. But there were kind of milestones, you know, just deciding to move to Atlanta was a decision, you know, when you're 21-ish, you know, deciding to do a startup was a decision. Yeah, a big decision, you know, deciding to move to New York. And we decided let's go where the customers are. And then one of the key things at DoubleClick, as we started getting bigger, is that the entire engineering staff was reporting to me. I had 300 or 400 people working for me. I had to learn how to manage large teams like that. So that was very challenging, you know, not something I ever envisioned myself doing or as a goal. One other thing that was obviously a huge challenge for us kind of along that kind of timeline at DoubleClick was just the sort of dot-com bust or the 2001 and the NASDAQ crashing and 70% of our customers going out of business. When 70% of your customers disappear, you know, that's a problem. So we had to kind of manage our way through that. I feel like there was one year where it was the majority of my time was just kind of working on retention and morale.
And having to let people go.
Yeah, a lot of people, yeah.
I want to talk about some of your other startups for a moment. You don't have a background in fashion. How did you land on Gilt Group and Business Insider?
Yeah, so with Gilt, which sells mainly like high-end fashion apparel at great prices online and has this concept of flash sales at noon, Kevin, I think, was the first one to bring up the idea and throw it out to me. One thing we were looking at was there was a company in Europe, Vent Privé, which was successful doing something kind of similar, but in Europe and in France. And then we thought, and we were like, well, would something like that make sense here? There's a lot of retailing online. There's a lot of e-commerce, but it feels like there's some gaps, some things that aren't bought a lot online. One of them being clothing, and another one being just the things that are on sale. You know, Kevin and I are working on multiple projects at this time, right? Mm-hmm. So if we did a new company, what we would do is, you know, we would basically hire a founding team, which was Alexis and Alexandra. You know, they were there day one, effectively, right? Mm-hmm. But this conversation about the idea and like, let's do this came previous.
And Business Insider, similar, came up with the idea and then founding team that you hired to go ahead and launch it.
Right. So Business Insider, we talked to Henry Blodgett and he was really, he liked the idea. So he came in as founder and CEO.
What makes you relax? What do you enjoy doing outside of work?
I like to ski. That's something we can do as a family because the kids ski.
Two girls.
So I like it. You know, if one can afford it, it's a little expensive, but you're outside and everyone is actually kind of interested in what's going on.
You have two girls, and I asked you before, you know, what your parents did and what influence they might have had on you. What might one of your girls say about you? What do you think they might say about you in a similar interview 10, 20 years from now?
Well, my older daughter likes to say that I invented the pop-up ad, which is actually not true. but in part, she's saying that to try to annoy me because pop-up ads are annoying. So they would say something like that.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Dwight Merriman. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.